Good morning, everyone. Today is either the last day of summer or the first day of fall. I'm not sure what time.
7:30 tomorrow.
Okay, so it's the last day of summer. Thank you. I didn't check when the official equinox is. But it seems a good day to kind of feel the rhythms, the cycles of our Earth, this beautiful Earth upon which we so utterly depend for our lives. And it's another very, very beautiful day to do that. And all over North America and maybe the world, today people are gathering and to reflect on and to encourage each other to find ways to respond to the crisis of climate change, which threatens the well-being of our Earth. So I thought we could do that today, and I wanted to make this an informal talk so we could have some time for some small group and large group discussion afterwards. And then some of us will go over to the CBC Plaza at 1 o'clock, where there's a rally of people coming together to express their care for the Earth and to take courage in responding to climate change. And it's said that there's the huge big march and rally in New York City today and many other cities. It's said that it's the largest collective demonstration in response to ecological crisis ever. So I thought over the last couple of months we've been kind of gradually expanding our view of Sangha. Michael gave a talk on family as Sangha. Sangha being the community of practitioners of the way of the Buddha. And strictly defined, Sangha is, originally it was the community of monks and nuns who practiced with the Buddha, and then also the lay people who practiced with the Buddha. And so, you know, we refer to our practice groups as sanghas. But really also, sangha, all beings are, whether they're intentionally on the path of awakening or not, it's our natural human way to seek freedom from suffering and to seek awakening. So even those who practice in other spiritual traditions or don't at all, who just struggle in their clumsy, sometimes misguided, sometimes even harmful ways to be free from suffering, are also by extension Sangha. And so we talked about being seeing our family members, you know, sometimes our difficult family relationships, as ground for practice, as Sangha. These are people who are seeking freedom from suffering too. So bodhisattvas in the making, right? And then we talked about seeing all human beings in our larger kind of interactions, group interactions on local community basis or international basis, and how we can bring that sense of our practice into the larger spheres of human relationships in a world where there's so much so much conflict and violence. And so today, we thought we could expand our sense of Sangha beyond the human to the animal and plant realms, and to the elements themselves, you know, our water, our soil, our air. If we don't have healthy water, air, and soil, we can't live on this earth, right? And if we don't have healthy plant and animal realms around us and that nourish us. So I thought I'd share with you a reading from the Huayan Sutra. The Huayan Sutra is a Chinese Mahayana text, and it's where the beautiful image of Indra's net is described. Indra's net is described as a vast, infinite net of interconnection, where each node of interconnection has a jewel, and that each jewel reflects every other jewel in the net. So it's a very kind of holographic model of the universe and of interconnection. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. So the Indra's net is a model of interbeing. So this is a passage also from the Huayan Sutra. It's called Serving Sentient Beings. In what manner should one accommodate and serve sentient beings? To do so, one should think. Throughout the realm of dharmas and the realm of space, in the ocean-like cosmos, in the 10 directions, there are infinite kinds of sentient beings. Some are born of eggs, some are born of the womb, of wetness, of metamorphosis. Some live by earth, some by water, fire, wind, space, trees, or flowers. Oh, countless are their kinds, and infinite are their forms, shapes, bodies, faces, lifespans, races, names, dispositions, views, knowledge, desires, inclinations, manners, costumes, and diets. They abide in numerous kinds of dwellings, in towns, villages, cities, and palaces. They comprise the devas, the nagas, the heavenly musicians, the tree nymphs, humans, non-humans, beings without feet, beings with two, four, or many feet. Some are with form, some are without form, some with or without thoughts, or neither with nor without thoughts. To all these infinite kinds of beings, I will render my service and accommodate them in whatever way is beneficial to them. And then there's a verse. Why should we cherish all sentient beings? Because sentient beings are the roots of the tree of awakening. The bodhisattvas and the buddhas are the flowers and the fruits. Compassion is the water for the roots. So that's a lot of sentient beings. You have all different kinds. Some of them mythic and not even visible. Some of them tinier than we can even see. And we vow to benefit them all, to live in a way that benefits them all. What would it be like if we really lived that way? I think there's a tendency to kind of feel paralyzed by that. How can I live in a way of that's non-harming to all beings? Well, it seems impossible. We can't even walk down the sidewalk without risking stepping on something, right? You know, we eat, beings perish too. Even if we are the strictest of vegans, beings perish to nourish our lives simply by gardening at all. Beings inadvertently we harm other beings' lives. So the vastness of this vow can seem really daunting and almost paralyzing, and so we have a tendency to just kind of push it away. I can't deal with that. Rather than really, really closely engaging with everything that we do in our lives and knowing when we cause harm, and to do so with regret, not regret exactly, awareness, full awareness that these creatures died to provide me with food, and great respect and gratitude, impeccable respect and gratitude for those lives. And to do everything we can for our lives to be as non-harming as possible and nourishing of other beings' lives. One of the... I also wanted to say, what if we lived that way? And what if we lived in a way that took into consideration the benefit of 7 generations forward as the First Nations people on this continent lived, and perhaps, and many of them still really feel that, I think, quite strongly. What if we took care of this earth in a way that would benefit 7 generations hence? What if we really lived that way? And one of the people who has been a real leader and teacher in this area is Joanna Macy. She's a scholar, an activist, a teacher. And her work originally was in the area of nonviolent social action, and also peace work and anti-nuclear work. And from that, she expanded to work in the area of deep ecology and environmental issues. And for decades, she's taught what she calls despair and empowerment workshops, where people from a base of deep inquiry and the stillness of meditation practice, where we investigate our deep feelings about the state of the world. And often, very strong grief arises. I know it can for me. And she has wonderful, creative, and expressive ways that people can feel their deep feelings about the earth and express them, and through that, also their aspiration. And that's where the empowerment comes in. So these the way she teaches is very encouraging and empowering. Though I've only appreciated her work through her writings and through doing some of the work in a small way ourselves, I haven't ever practiced with her. So I thought I'd read you a passage that she wrote, because I can't say it any better. And it's from this book, A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. And it's just a 3-page piece called On Being with Our World. This is Joanna Macy's words. To give full attention to the perils confronting our world invites an almost excruciating tension. It is the tension between seeing the enormity of the peril, such as climate chaos, mass extinctions, nuclear warfare, and seeing the inadequacy of our response to it. It takes courage to endure these tensions, yet endure them we must, for to be conscious enough to act responsibly requires being awake to the possibility of failure. The other day we were talking about the impossibility of our bodhisattva vows. And yet, we use them to align our speech and our actions and our practice. So we have to be able to stay upright even in the face of discouragement and what seems like failure. In my work in the environmental peace and justice movements, I share my conviction that spiritual practices can provide the moral strength to see things as they are. It is my experience that spiritual grounding, especially in the Buddha Dharma, can keep us from shutting down or succumbing, shutting down on the one hand, or on the other hand, succumbing to wishful thinking. Practices that steady the mind and open the heart help us to be more present in our world. Buddhist teachings bring me home to this beautiful suffering world. They let me glimpse my non-separateness from it. In those moments, I experience my inter-existence with all that is and realize that there is ultimately no need to fear. That knowing has been reinforced by many of the people with whom I have worked, students and teachers and organizers from all walks of life and faith traditions. Yet I also encounter people, including some on the Buddhist path, whose notions of spirituality hinder them from engaging with the world and realizing their power to effect change. Among the spiritual traps that cut the nerve of compassionate action are these. First, that the phenomenal world is an illusion. Right? We've all heard that in our Buddhist practice and studies, the world's an illusion. Impermanent and made of matter, it is somehow less worthy than a realm of pure spirit. Its pain and its demands on us are less real than the pleasures or tranquility we can find in transcending them. Well, this is something I really appreciate about Zen practice, is it doesn't let us get away with this split between the world as illusion and somehow other than the material world is where we need to be or set our sights. Zen practice really supports us to practice right here in this body, in this world, fully awake and fully engaged. Second, that suffering is somehow a mistake. Pain we may feel in beholding the world derives from our own cravings and attachments. According to this view, freedom from suffering is attained by non-attachment rather than non-attachment to, the world or our surroundings, rather than non-attachment to self-clinging. To the self, the ego. So again, that's where I think our Zen perspective of non-duality really helps us to not say, oh, well, that's all out there, and my practice is to be non-attached. Non-attachment, yes, but not detachment. I think that might be a helpful distinction. Yeah, so we can be non-attached in the sense of we don't have our personal agenda, and we're not going to take it really personally if our action doesn't succeed the way we hoped. We persist, we keep going. Next one, that we create our world unilaterally by the power of our mind. How many of us have heard that little cliche, I create my world, or I create my... Well, yes and no. Our subjective thoughts dictate the form things will take. Thus, grief for the plight of the world is negative thinking. Oh, don't be a down, don't be negative. Right? How many of you heard that? Confronting injustice and dangers simply creates more conflict and suffering. So we have to kind of gloss over with a kind of kind kind of superficial positive attitude. I think we have to watch this kind of thinking. And yes, our thinking shapes our world, but it's not unilateral. It's in complete interaction with other beings. We are always influencing and being influenced, so it's dynamic. It's not one way. And all our complex human feelings are included. Next one. That the world is already perfect when we view it spiritually. We feel then so peaceful that the world will become peaceful without our need to act. So again, this is something we have to be a little careful with. You know, we've heard everything is perfect just as it is through our non-dual perspective. So yes, and at Suzuki Roshi, who founded our particular Zen lineage, used to tell his students, you're all perfect just the way you are, and you could use a little improvement. So the kind of perfectness that being that this everything is perfect just as it is a very, it's not our conventional perfectness. It's a perfectness that includes a great deal of ugliness and suffering with a kind of just seeing it. This is our human life, our human condition. This is our world, and it's incredibly, deeply kind of poignant and moving and beautiful in its totality. It's not a pretty perfectness. It's an everything included perfectness. And it includes our need to respond. It's dynamic. We are free, of course, to seek escape from the suffering of our world. But the price for such comfort is high. It is my experience that the world itself has a role to play in our awakening. So if we shut out the world, we're missing a lot. Its very brokenness and need to call us, summoning us to walk out of the prison of our self-concern. As we do that, we venture into the danger and uncertainty. As we do that, we venture into danger and uncertainty in service to life on earth. Discoveries await us. These discoveries are symbolized by two hand gestures or mudras in the of the Buddha. On carvings and paintings, we see them. One is the Bhumi Sparsha, or earth-touching mudra. Have you seen the Buddha in this gesture of touching the earth? Which recalls the act that Gautama made when, at the outset of his vigil beneath the Bodhi tree, he was challenged by Mara. Mara is kind of a, sometimes he's called a devil figure, but that's not quite it. He's a tempter. He's a tempter, and he kind of embodies or is kind of an archetypal figure that represents our fears, our distractions, and our doubts. What gets in the way of our clear seeing, that keep us from awakening to the unity we have with all life. So when Mara demands to know by what authority Gautama seeks the cessation of suffering, the one about to become Buddha quietly touches the earth. Instead of offering any personal credentials to show his worthiness to awaken for the sake of all beings, he touches the earth, our ground of being. The central doctrine that he will teach, our dependent co-arising with all things, gives us that same authority. Our inseparability from all that is gives us power to act on behalf of all beings. So it's the earth itself that empowers us to care for the earth. Stemming from that profound understanding comes the second gesture of the Buddha that calls me into life. It is the Abhaya Mudra. With right hand raised, palm forward, it means fear not. You've seen that one in Buddhist art and imagery as well. Don't be afraid. You will never be severed from the web of life, for that is what you are. The gesture is similar to the traditional Native American greeting that we used to see in movies. How? But that's the same meaning. I come in peace. It's a gesture of non-harming. I greet you and show you my open hand. I carry no weapon. Do not fear. When the perils and tensions of this planet time seem hard to bear, these two mudras, with all they connote, help me stay present to my world, says Joanna Macy. And I think we could add one more, and that would be the palms together over the heart of our gassho, which we do a lot in our practice. We can't be raising our hand to strike if they're together over our heart. So this is a wonderful gesture of peace and mutual respect when we bow to each other. So I've been looking in this book called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. And it's an anthology of many short essays and some poems by spiritual leaders, activists, scholars, poets, teachers from various traditions, not just including Buddhists. And all the contributions are in answer to this question. Do we have a moral obligation to take action to protect the future of a planet in peril? Well, it's kind of a, you know, it's an easy question, isn't it? Yes or no? It's a yes-no question. And to me, the more interesting and provocative question is how? How? Because we're really, you know, in a sense, all this book is preaching to the converted, although maybe it's a good source book for those who are speaking out and encouraging others to do so, as we are today. But I wanted to read you the categories. There are eight section heads in the book. And each of them begins with the word yes. We talked on a Wednesday night. We've been doing some mindfulness practices to kind of get ready to warm up for our upcoming practice period. And one of them that Michael selected was saying yes. You know, to be aware of how often we respond in our life with no. It's so easy to say no, no, I don't want this, I don't want to do that, no. Makes us feel about 5 years old, but we do it a lot. So our practice was to say yes to our experience, not in a way of, you know, it might be an unpleasant experience. It might be something we actually really don't like. But to say to yes in the sense of, I'm going to meet this experience. I'm going to see it clearly, and I'm going to respond to it. No is the pushing away. So it doesn't mean we were saying yes that we're always approving of everything, but saying yes, I'm not going to turn away from this, I'm going to meet this. And it was those of us who tried that practice for the week, really, it got some very interesting insights, particularly into how quickly we say no. So these are ways to say yes. Yes to that question. Yes, we have a moral obligation to take action to protect the future of a planet in peril. So I'm just going to read these section heads and see for each one, does it resonate? How does it resonate for you? Yes, for the survival of humankind. Yes, for the sake of the children. Yes, for the sake of the earth itself. Yes, for the sake of all forms of life on the planet. Yes, to honor our duties of gratitude and reciprocity. Yes, for the full expression of human virtue. Yes, because all flourishing is mutual. Yes, for the stewardship of creation. Yes, because compassion requires it. Yes, because justice demands it. Yes, because the world is beautiful. Yes, because we love the world. Yes, to honor and celebrate the earth and earth systems. Yes, because our moral integrity requires us to do what is right. So, thank you, I talked too long. I lost track of the time. What I'd like us to do with our remaining time, and then we'll have some tea together in the kitchen, is just to turn to our neighbor. 2, 4, 6, 8. Oh, no, let's do threes. 3, 3, 3, 3, 4. That's all right. So just make little clusters of threes and one of four. And I'd like each person, just briefly, to take a couple of minutes to say what moves me to respond to care for the earth. There's, you know, what of those things I just read resonates for you? What, and how do you feel that non-separation from the earth, what moves you to care? And maybe an example of how. So each of you, just take a couple of minutes each and speak personally about that.
Do you want us just to self-time?
I will ring a bell after...